Lecture 32, The Exodus. Did it happen?
Hello again. Welcome back. Remember last time we ended with the death of my man Ramses the Great? I'd like to take a little bit of a chronological detour. We're not going to talk about the next king. I want to talk about the Bible, about Exodus in particular, because many people feel that Ramses is the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Now, what I'd like to do is basically tell you the Exodus story. We'll talk about the story of Exodus as it is in the Bible, and then we'll look to see, how do you get evidence for this? Is there any internal evidence? Is there any external evidence? And we'll see, did it really happen? Now, first of all, about Exodus. One of the curious things about the biblical tale of Exodus is that there is practically no archaeological evidence to support it. There are many things in the Bible that we have found archaeological evidence for. Many. But when it comes to Exodus, the record seems blank. There's no record of large numbers of Israelites in Egypt. We don't have a record of any man named Moses. None of that. So it's very difficult to try to figure out, did this thing really happen or not? But what we'll do is, as I say, we'll talk about the story as it's presented, and then we'll see, is there any way we can get some sort of evidence for it, or maybe decide it didn't happen. First, the story. Well, one of the things about Exodus is it's the foundation of the Jewish faith. It is crucial. The Exodus story is mentioned more in the Old Testament than any other event in the Bible. Right? It's mentioned more than any other event. And it really deals with three stages in the history of the Israelites. First, it's the Israelites in bondage. Right? That's sort of part of it. Then it's the Exodus itself, when they leave. And then it's the third stage, where they wander and finally come to the Promised Land. Right? Let's start with Israel in bondage. Now, remember way back when we talked about the Joseph story? Joseph was the son of Jacob called Israel. And this is why they're called the children of Israel. These are the 12 sons of Jacob who eventually settle in Egypt. Right? But this is way back in history for the Egyptians. But we know that there are these stories about Jacob's children, the children of Israel, being in Egypt. But when we left the story, remember, Joseph was the vizier of Egypt. He had saved Egypt because he figured out the dream, the Pharaoh's dream, and he realized there would be 7 good years and 7 years of famine. And by planning the economy for 14 years, by putting grain aside, he saves the economy. He's the hero. But that's in the past, because the Exodus story starts with, and a new Pharaoh came to the throne who knew not Joseph. So this is the past. And it's important. He knew not Joseph, meaning this was the heyday of the Israelites in Egypt. This Pharaoh didn't know about that. Now, we are told many details in Exodus, and it's the details that makes it wonderful. For example, these Israelites who are now living in Egypt, in the Delta area, they are numerous. They are prospering. And this bothers Pharaoh. He wants them to be under his thumb. So he puts taskmasters over them, enslaves them, right? Does all kinds of things to keep their numbers down, keep them in check, right? And he says, and the Bible says, they worked in brick, right? Now notice, by the way, they didn't work in stone. That's a detail. They're working in bricks. That's important. Remember, by the way, these Israelites did not build the pyramids. The pyramids were built 1,000, you know, they're way earlier. Reign of Sneferu, Old Kingdom. This is common misconception, often seen in movies. You know, you've got these slaves hauling blocks up. No way. Not only didn't they build the pyramids, they worked in brick. Right? Now, even so, they're becoming more numerous, those Israelites. And Pharaoh tells the midwives, and these are the people who are in charge of the births, right? Tell the midwives, it's a curious phrase, we'll talk about it later, but remember it. Watch the two stones. That's what Pharaoh says to the midwives. Watch the two stones. Now, what we'll do is, as an Egyptologist, I'm going to try to interpret what this might mean. So we're going to go through the story first, and then we'll see how it works. Watch the two stones. So that they may kill the Israelite male children, right? Pharaoh wants the midwives to kill the male children. But they don't. They don't. They actually give Pharaoh a story. When these male children keep popping up, Pharaoh says, hey, how come you didn't kill the male children? They say, well, these Israelites are really tough. They give birth before we get there even. Right? So they've got and we're even told, by the way, that the midwives are rewarded by Yahweh, by God, and they prosper, right? Because they did this thing. Anyway, we have Moses being born, a central thing, right? And his mother is, of course, afraid that he's going to be killed, the male Israelite, and she sets him adrift in this basket, you know, and the Pharaoh's daughter finds the basket, and she's going to take the kid in, and she names him Moses. And the Bible tells us he's named Moses because he is drawn out of the bulrushes, taken out of the reeds, right? And the Hebrew word masa is to draw out. So there's a kind of Hebrew etymology for this. It is kind of curious, by the way, that the Pharaoh's daughter, this Egyptian, you know, woman, is going to name him a Hebrew name. Right? Think about that. It's kind of curious. But anyway, that's what the Bible tells us. Moses is actually nurtured by his own mother. The princess has to get a wet nurse. Says, find some Israelite who will nurse him. And it's Moses' own mother who nurtures him. And he grows up. And eventually we know that he has an encounter with God in the burning bush. Right? That's how he encounters God. And God, as the burning bush, tells Moses. He says, Moses, you're going to be instrumental in freeing the children of Israel from bondage. Now, Moses is a little hesitant. He says, me? How am I going to do it, you know? And he talks about, you know, says it's a kind of personal interchange almost. He says, how am I going to do this? And Moses says, Moses, don't worry. He says, you've got a staff? Throw your staff down. And it turns into a snake, right? So Moses is going to be given these powers that will do it. And if you remember also, there's the thing with the hand. He never uses this. Moses' hand becomes leprous, puts it in his cloak, becomes leprous, pulls it out. It's healed. So the idea is, I'm behind you, Moses. It'll work. And Moses is instructed to go to Pharaoh and tell him, let my people go. And Moses says, I'm not really a good speaker, right? And it's basically what he says, I don't really speak that well. How can I do this? And God says, all right, you can take Aaron with you, your brother, you know, who's a better speaker, right? Moses says, I'm slow of speech. So the deal is that Moses can take Aaron. He's going with divine powers. He's going to go to Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh, let my people go. He has the audience with Pharaoh. Now, crucial, crucial, crucial for us. We are never told who the Pharaoh is. The only way he is referred to is as Pharaoh. Now, Pharaoh, up until this point, is not an Egyptian way of referring to the king. It's not really. Nesut was one way the king was called. There are many words for king. This is not quite the normal way. It's a corruption, or a conjunction, actually, of two Egyptian words, though. Per, which means house, and ah, which means great. So it really, the person who lived in the great house, the palace, was the king. So he is referred to as the one who lives in the great house, the Pera, the Pharaoh. Okay? This is when we first get this term introduced. Later in Egyptian history, we'll even get it used on temple walls, Pera, but no, this is an unusual term. So he's referred to only as Pharaoh. We don't know who he is. We don't. The only clue we get to his identity is that the cities that the Israelites are building with these bricks are called the cities of Ramses and Pitom. So one of the cities is named Ramses. But remember, there are plenty of kings named Ramses. And Pitom means something like the house of Atum. So it's a god city, right? And they're building these store cities, we're even told. Store cities means where you store things. Right? So we don't know who Pharaoh is, but they go to him and they say, hey, let my people go. Not only that, I mean, it's what we would call chutzpah. They say, we want 3 days off to celebrate a festival to our God. Right? It's amazing. And Pharaoh really thinks this is outrageous. And Moses, you know, does the serpent thing. He knows he's got this staff that God showed him. And he throws the staff down, you know. It's actually Aaron's staff that's thrown on the ground. and it turns into a serpent. But the amazing thing, when you read the Bible, and everybody, that's your homework assignment, Exodus 1 through 14. You'll love it after this, I think. Exodus 1 through 14. The amazing thing in the story is nobody's impressed. Pharaoh's magicians take their staffs, they throw it down, they throw them down, and they turn into serpents. Apparently, it's the old snake trick that everybody knew. The only saving thing for Moses is that his staff swallows the others. Right? So that's pretty good. That's a plus. At least he's beaten. And it's an interesting thing about how nobody's impressed by this staff turning into a serpent. But anyway, Pharaoh refuses. He says, not only that, you're not getting your 3 days off to celebrate your holiday, but we are not going to give you any straw for your bricks. Now, this is crucial. Bricks in Egypt were made with straw to give it strength. You chopped straw, and mixed it in with the clay so that your bricks would have a kind of consistency that would hold together. It was for strength. Now, in the 19th century, by the way, there were quasi-biblical scholars who were looking throughout Egypt for bricks without straw as evidence of the Bible. But this was kind of silly, really. If you read the text carefully, they're not telling the Israelites to make bricks without straw. They're telling the Israelites, you've got a quota, you've got to make the same number of bricks, but now we're not going to supply the chopped straw. You're going to have to chop your own straw, mix it into the mud, and make it into bricks. That's what you're going to have to do. So it's harder work. You've got the same quota, more jobs to do. You got to chop your straw and all that. So it's just more difficult. Right? And by the way, you know, as part of my sort of research on the Exodus, I went to brickyards in ancient Egypt in the south, and they still make bricks the same way. Guys bring a big... It's actually, they use cut truck tires as baskets, and they got chopped straw, they dump it in, they mix it in the mud with their feet, and then they have little brick molds, and they make bricks. I mean, it's quite interesting to see it. It's back into biblical times. Anyway, Pharaoh refuses. He's not going to let them go. You got to make more work for you. And then come the plagues, as you all know, the 10 plagues. And the plagues, the first 9 plagues, do not convince Pharaoh to let the Israelites go. We have darkness. The river turns to blood. We have mosquitoes. Right? We have boils. We have frogs. We have locusts. All of these plagues. Now, the interesting thing to me about the first 9 plagues is that they can all be explained as natural phenomena. Even the river turning to blood. Remember when we talked about the inundation, when the Nile overflowed its banks? And what happened was that from the south, you get these monsoon rains from Ethiopia swelling the Nile, and with it comes topsoil, red topsoil. So the river actually did turn red once a year. So that's not that astounding. Now, when you call it blood, it might be blood red. Or even, for example, darkness. One of the plagues is when darkness comes during the day. Sandstorm, perhaps. Mosquitoes, boils, you know. It's all natural phenomena. But the one phenomenon that seems to really be different, the one that eventually moves Pharaoh, is the death of the firstborn. Moses tells Pharaoh, all the firstborn children will be killed. Now Moses has been told by God that his people will be spared. If you remember the story, he is told to take the blood of a lamb and they put it over the door sill of the Israelites' houses so that the angel of death, when he comes to slay all the firstborn, and it's firstborn cattle, it's firstborn, you know, of the maid who is working on the grindstone, the angel of the Lord will see the blood and will pass over that household. And that's why today, of course, the celebration is Passover. It celebrates the passing over of the angel of the Lord so that the firstborn of the Israelites were spared. And of course it happens. All the firstborn are killed. And this is when Pharaoh finally relents. When he finally says, you can go. And this is when the Exodus begins. Now there's a funny detail. I'm not sure exactly what it means. But when Moses was talking to God in the form of the burning bush, God said, you'll be freed. You know, God even says, he always says to Moses, Pharaoh's heart will be hardened. But he even says that he, Yahweh, will harden Pharaoh's heart. So in other words, it seems to be some sort of test of the Israelites' resolve. But he says, when you leave, you will leave with gold and silver. You will plunder the Egyptians. So that's what he says. That's what happens. Everybody is so shocked by this firstborn that when the Israelites want to take gold and silver, they give it to them. So the Israelites start to leave on their exodus with gold and silver. Now, how many are involved in the exodus? The Bible tells us 600,000. And it even says men, not including families, right? The Hebrew is elephim, you know, thousand. It's a plural of thousand. 600,000 men, not including families. Now, that's a large number. The population of Egypt probably was about 1 million at the time. So it's the kind of number that used to say, whoa, something's wrong here. But that's what we're told. And it says they had been in Egypt for 430 years. We have an idea of the time since Joseph, perhaps. Now, how do they leave? Well, obviously, they're leaving on foot. And we are told some details of their route. First, they don't leave by the Philistine route. Now, the Philistine route is going into Palestine. You know, we get Palestine from Philistine. And this is a route that's guarded. There are watchtowers. They don't want to go that route. So they go through, they're in the delta, they go through the marsh. Now, there is a common mistranslation of Yam Suf, which is the word for where they go through. It's the Sea of Reeds. They don't go through the Red Sea. No, they're not swimming or whatever. It's the Sea of Reeds. And we're even given a detail, I think, that suggests why it's the Sea of Reeds makes much more sense. As they're escaping, if you remember, God parts the waters. People are afraid, but God parts the waters. And then, if you'll remember, Pharaoh all of a sudden changes his mind, jumps into his chariot, takes some of his charioteers, and they pursue the Israelites. And we're told, though, that the chariots of Pharaoh are clogged. Now, that sounds like they're going through mud. See, the Israelites undoubtedly don't have chariots. They weren't used to that kind of thing. They were the slaves. They're going on foot. They're dragging whatever they can. But chariots could get bogged down in the Sea of Reeds where people could indeed walk through it. So, in the end, we know the river is closed on Pharaoh's army. Right? And they perish. And then comes the wandering, of course. They wander in the wilderness and eventually reach the promised land of milk and honey. The Exodus story. Now, let's see if we can get any evidence for it. Is there any way you can try to, you know, because as I say, there's no straightforward archaeological evidence. No man named Moses. No large list of Israelite captives. None of that. Well, first of all, why is there no record of it if it happened? Well, I think one reason is the Egyptian concept of history. They never kept records of defeat. Never. They never recorded losses, and this would have been a loss. You know, if you read all of the battle accounts of all the pharaohs, they won every one. They just, some of them, they kept winning closer to home as they retreated. But there's no sense of objective history. So the Egyptians wouldn't have recorded it. Another reason, perhaps, why we don't get a record of it is this is crucial to the Israelites. It is a foundation of the religious faith. But it wasn't that important to anyone else in the Middle East. It was an event that happened perhaps to a small number of people. Now, if I had to guess, now, I've already said I think 600,000 is certainly impossible. But you know how stories are when you tell it, right? The fish gets bigger, you know, and the victory gets bigger. So in the course of telling this story, it grows to thousands. My bet, if something happened, 600, maybe. It could even be maybe 60. Maybe it's a couple of large families that get out. But I think it's the kind of event that the Middle East, the ancient Middle East, just didn't care about. You think the Hittite king cares about what's happening with these people leaving? It's a little bit like, you know, look in the Middle East records in 1770s for what's happening in America, the American Revolution. It's not much about it. Nobody cared. And it may be a similar thing. So it's not surprising that we don't have records. But do we have any way of getting at this thing. Is it true? Is it false? Let's look at internal evidence. Does the story hold together internally? Well, first of all, there were indeed cities of Pithom and Ramses. Those are talked about in the Bible. They existed in the Delta, just where the Israelites worked, right? Ramses built them. Now, bricks are used for storehouse, not stone. That's good. That works. Also, bricks are made with straw. In Egypt they are, but you know, in Canaan, they didn't make bricks with straw. So this is a nice detail where the Canaanites, writing this story later, are saying, they've got it right. The Egyptians used straw. That's pretty good. Also, the names of the towns are pretty good. You know, when it says Pithom and Ramses, they could have been using later names in the Bible. They could have used Tanis, which it was called later. People thought that was that. No, they don't. They've got the names right. That's pretty good. Also, you know what I think about sometimes? Remember Aaron and Moses are coming daily to Pharaoh? Oh, you didn't like boils? Wait till you see locusts. You know, they keep coming back. Well, they were working in the Delta, right next to the palace. So that makes it possible to go back and forth and have these, you know, conferences with the Pharaoh daily. So the logistics sort of works. Now, remember the midwives. I said, remember that thing about watch the two stones? That's a nice detail. Ancient Egyptian women gave birth in a seated position. It's a good position to give birth in. Gravity helps you. Gravity assists the birth. And women used a special birthing stool, which was sometimes two blocks of stone. And you sat on the two blocks of stone. Or sometimes it was built up out of bricks. So when the midwives are told, watch the two stones, that's good Egyptian detail. Somebody knew what he was talking about. These people were in Egypt. This is a good detail. So there's some kind of internal consistency here. Also, you know, that phrase, Pharaoh's heart was hardened, very Egyptian. Very Egyptian. The Egyptians believed you thought with your heart. Because when you get excited, of course, it's your heart that beats quickly, not your brain. And the heart was viewed as the seat of all emotions. So Pharaoh's heart was hardened. That's a nice detail. I like that. I think one other thing that I sort of liked, the serpent trick, the old serpent trick. I wondered about that. I've wondered about that for years. And about 5 years ago, I was in Egypt. And I decided to see if I could find a snake charmer. There's still snake charmers in Egypt. That's a wonderful thing. I wanted to see if I could find a snake charmer who could do it. You know, I figured, if Pharaoh's men aren't impressed, it's got to be a trick that people know. Found a snake charmer in the south of Egypt who worked with cobras. Now, I don't know if these were poisonous or not, if they had been defanged or what, but they were cobras. There's no question about that. And I said, hey, can you do this? Can you make your cobra look like a staff? And he did it. It was not exactly as in the Bible, but I was impressed. He took this cobra, and he holds it up in his hand, and his cobra's kind of wriggling around, you know, kind of wriggling a lot, and all of a sudden, the cobra goes rigid, and it looks like the top of the cobra's head is the top of a walking stick, and you've got this guy holding what looks like a staff with the head carved like a cobra, and then he throws it on the ground, and it wriggles away. That's pretty good. I mean, sure, it's pressure on nerves. He's probably squeezing the poor thing to death. Who knows what? But this cobra looked like a staff. Then he did something that really blew me away. I didn't know it was coming. It was kind of had this standard magic trick, I guess he did. He took the cobra, and he tied it in a knot, and he put it on top of his head so that you had the cobra's head kind of pointing out towards you from him. And you know what it looked like? Remember that the sign of the Pharaoh was the uraeus, the cobra, on the forehead? That's what it looked like. And I mean, he had no idea that this went back to ancient Egypt, but it certainly looked like that, that he had a crown with a cobra coming out of it. So even this serpent trick, there's still some traces of it in Egypt. Now, what about his name, Moses? Remember I said we talk about Moses? It is not reasonable to think that a princess, an Egyptian princess, is going to pick a kid out of the water and then start speaking Hebrew and give him an Egyptian name, Moses. No. That's a bad etymology. It doesn't work. Moses is a purely Egyptian name. It means birth. And it makes sense, given that she's got this kid now, a new kid. It's like her birth. She calls him Moses. Moses is pure Egyptian. For example, Ramses' name is really Ramoses. Ra is born. The pharaoh Thutmose III, our great warrior. It means Toph, the ibis-headed god is born. Toph Moses. So this is a purely Egyptian name, and it makes more sense when you look at it from an Egyptological standpoint than just biblical that, oh, it's a Hebrew word. No. So that's pretty good too. Now, that's a lot of internal stuff. What about external stuff? You know, is there any way we could find evidence for this Exodus? Well, as I said, the Delta is pretty good. Ramses' capital, Ramses the Great, and I'm going to suggest that he might be the pharaoh of the Exodus. They did build a city of Ramses in Pitom. His capital was in the Delta. He built these big cities. So it's starting to look like there's some bit of historicity to this story. Also, let me tell you about a papyrus that's in the Leiden Museum. It's got just one sentence that's important, but it's a really good sentence for us. Here's what it says. It's instructions for workers, for overseers of the workers. And it says, distribute grain rations to the soldiers and to the apiru to transport stones to the great pylon of Ramses. Now, Ramses' city was being built also, not just the store city, you have temples. And it says, soldiers and apiru. Sounds very much like Hebrew. And many people think that the Hapiru, who were a Bedouin in the north, that these may be the Hebrews. So we have a suggestion that this may be our Israelites, may be in Egypt. Now, there's one more bit that's really the cornerstone. It's called the Merneptah Stela. Now remember, Ramses' firstborn son, Amenherkepchef, he died before he became pharaoh. It's the 13th son, and we're going to talk a lot about him next time. It's the 13th son, Merneptah, who becomes king. In the fifth year of his reign, he erects a stela, talking about all his victories. This is the first place in the Egyptian record where Israel is mentioned. We never get it during the reign of Ramses. We get it during the fifth year of the reign of Merneptah. And I'll tell you what he says. On the stela, he says, Canaan has been plundered into every sort of woe. All right, so he's going to list the country that he's beaten up. Canaan has been plundered into every sort of woe. Ashkelon has been overcome. Gezer has been captured. Yanoam has been made non-existent. Israel is laid waste. Its seed is not. Israel is laid waste. Its seed is not. Now, first mention of Israel. Important to note, he's not talking about the Exodus. Many people think Merneptah is the pharaoh of the Exodus. But he's talking about battles outside of Egypt. He's listing all these places he's beaten up. But what's crucial is this. It's the way the word Israel is written. If you look at all of these countries that he's talking about, right? He's got Canaan, Ashkelon, Gezer, right? All of these. At the end of that word for that country is the sign for a foreign land. It's a hill, three hills, because foreign lands had lots of hills. That's how you said country. When he refers to Israel, there is no country sign. What you have is a sign of a man and a woman. In other words, Israel at this point is not a country. It's not an established place. It's a peoples. It's a people. Now, what that suggests is that they have not established themselves yet. They are still wandering. So, during the time of Merneptah, it suggests that Israel has not yet established itself. Now, if you do a little mathematics, which is kind of neat, if you count backwards, year 5 of Merneptah, the only pharaoh whose reign this could have come into, if the Israelites are still wandering, is the previous one, Ramses the Great, who ruled for 67 years. And many people, biblical scholars, Ken Kitchen's a great scholar on Ramses the Great, suggest that it happened sometime around year 20 of Ramses' reign even. Right? Sometime around there. Now, what's interesting is that, remember, that's when Ramses' firstborn son, Amenherkepchef, dies. Roughly. So, we've got some consistency here that something may have happened. Right? May have. The death of Ramses' firstborn child may indeed have come during this Exodus period. And Amenherkepchef may be that firstborn son who dies. So it is possible that something happened, not 600,000, something much smaller, but there is some evidence that something like the Exodus may have happened. And if it did, I think it probably happened during the reign of Ramses the Great. But next time, we'll talk a little bit more about Ramses, but a different Ramses. We're going to talk about Ramses' mummy, and then about this 13th son, Merneptah, who becomes king of Egypt. We'll do that next.